Job chapter 33, beginning with verse 1. This is Elihu speaking now. Wherefore, Job, I pray thee, hear my speeches, and hearken to all my words. Behold now, I have opened my mouth. My tongue has spoken in my mouth. My words shall be of the uprightness of my heart, and my lips shall utter knowledge clearly. The Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life. If thou canst, answer me. Set thy words in order before me. Stand up. Behold, I am according to thy wish in God's stead. I also am formed out of the clay. Behold, my terror shall not make thee afraid, neither shall my hand be heavy upon thee. Surely thou hast spoken in mine hearing, and I have heard the voice of thy words, saying, I am clean without transgression, I am innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he findeth occasions against me. He counteth me for his enemy. He putteth my feet in the stocks. He marketh all my paths. Behold, in this thou art not just. I will answer thee that God is greater than man. Why dost thou strive against him? For he giveth not account of any of his matters. For God speaketh once, yea, twice, yet man perceiveth it not. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men, in slumberings upon the bed, then he openeth the ears of men and sealeth their instruction, that he may withdraw man from his purpose and hide pride from man. He keepeth back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. He is chastened also with pain upon his bed, and the multitude of his bones with strong pain, so that his life abhorreth bread, and his soul dainty meat. His flesh is consumed away, that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. Yea, his soul draweth near unto the grave, and his life to the destroyers. If there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand to show unto man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. He shall pray unto God, and he will be favorable unto him, and he shall see his face with joy, for he will render unto man his righteousness. He looketh upon men, and if any say, I have sinned and perverted that which was right, and it profited me not, he will deliver his soul from going into the pit, and his life shall see the light. Lo, all these things worketh God oft times with man, to bring back his soul from the pit, to be enlightened with the light of the living. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me. Hold thy peace, and I will speak. If thou hast anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify thee. If not, hearken unto me, hold thy peace, and I shall teach thee wisdom. Amen. We'll end our reading at the end of the chapter, knowing that the Lord will add his own blessing to the reading of his word for his name's sake. I want to call your attention in particular to the words of verses 23 and 24. If there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand to show unto man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. Underscore those words in particular. Deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. Elihu is thought by many to be perhaps the most perplexing character in the book of Job. He sees how inadequate the counsel of Job's friends has been, and so he steps forward when the debate between Job and his friends has come to a draw. He hath not directed his words against me, Elihu says in the previous chapter, chapter 32 and verse 14. He hath not directed his words against me, neither will I answer him with your speeches, Elihu says. And so you get the impression that Elihu's going to be different. He recognizes that Job's friends have been ineffective. I'm not going to answer him the way you men answered him. But then the perplexity sets in. Does he then answer Job with the same kind of arguments as Job's friends? It cannot be denied that much of what Elihu says can be cross-referenced to what Job's friends have said earlier. But while this is true, there are also many statements that Elihu makes that cannot be cross-referenced to Job's three friends. And especially is this true in the chapter we've just read. There is much throughout the book of Job that can remind the reader, through Job's sufferings, of the sufferings of Christ. Indeed, I think understanding the sufferings of Christ is essential to a right understanding of Job's sufferings and hence to our own sufferings as a Christian. People have approached this book like it's some kind of a deep mystery. I know I've shared with you. This was the first book I ever read as a Christian. I think I had actually read Fox's Book of Martyrs. So I was well aware of the fact that Christians suffer. Somebody said to me, if you want to know why Christians suffer, read the book of Job. So I read it. And when I was done, I was scratching my head. And I was saying, I still don't know why Christians suffer. When you learn to read the book in the broader context of redemption as a whole, that mystery is not nearly so difficult as it might seem. And in fact, I think the answer is a very simple one as to the Christian suffering. The Christian will suffer because our Savior suffered and we're being conformed to Him. That explains a lot then about sufferings. And when you look at Job's sufferings in that light, you can see a lot in Job's example that will remind you of Christ. Now in chapter 33, I see much in the character of Elihu that can remind the reader of Christ. Especially Christ in his mediatorial office as a prophet. That comes out, I think, clearly in verse 23. If there be a messenger, that's a prophet. The word is translated in other versions by the word angel, and we know that an angel is a messenger. So I think we have at the very least here an allusion to Christ's prophetic office. But if you look at an earlier verse, verse 4 in chapter 33, where Elihu says, "The Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life." And while that statement is true of men in general, it certainly serves to remind us that it's no less true of Christ. "Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, Sacrifice and offering thou wouldst not, but a body hast thou prepared me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hast had no pleasure. Then said I, Lo, I come. In the volume of the book it is written of me to do thy will, O God. Behold, I am according to thy wish, in God's stead," Elihu says in verse 6. And if you know the book of Job, then you know that this is what Job desired. A daysman is the term that's used earlier in the book. One that could come and stand before Job and hear Job and speak to Job in such a way that his terror wouldn't paralyze Job. "I'm come according to thy wish, in God's stead," Elihu says in verse 6, "I also am formed out of the clay. Behold, my terror shall not make thee afraid, neither shall my hand be heavy upon thee." Isn't that true of Christ? He came to represent God. He came to speak for God. He is the Word, the Logos. In the beginning was the Word. He too was formed, at least his humanity, out of the clay. And when he spoke, it was not with the thunderous voice that was heard from Mount Sinai, but it was a man's voice that was heard. A man who had no form nor comeliness so as to be regarded as terrifying. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me. Hold thy peace, and I will speak. Elihu says in verse 31, if thou hast anything to say, answer me, speak, for I desire to justify thee. Here perhaps is where the greatest contrast is seen between Elihu and Job's friends. Elihu desires to justify Job. Job's friends were intensely engaged in the process of trying to condemn Job. And isn't this the same desire that Christ has manifested towards sinners? He desires not to condemn them, but to justify them. What a marvel of grace. And these communion elements are designed to show us that Christ accomplished that desire by becoming a man and by shedding his blood. This morning I want to draw your attention, as I said, to a unique statement made by Elihu, found in verses 23 and 24. If there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand to show unto man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. I said a moment ago, some English versions translate the word messenger with the word angel. They also translate the word interpreter by the word mediator. An angel is a messenger. And in his mediatorial office as our prophet, Christ, you could say, is an interpreter. What I want to focus on this morning, though, is the declaration of this messenger or this interpreter. Look at what this interpreter says. Deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. The word ransom is the same word that can be translated atonement. I found a ransom, or I found an atonement. And again, aren't we reminded how from the days of antiquity, if you take Job to be the author of this book, it would make him the oldest author of any book in the Bible. And the knowledge that is displayed from the days of antiquity about salvation are really quite remarkable. I fear that we don't give Old Testament saints enough credit for what they knew and for what they understood. The gospel message in this statement is too clear to miss. As sinners, our need is for deliverance. We're headed for the pit, and we're helpless and hopeless to do anything about it. But before the sentence can be executed, there comes the declaration that there can be and there is deliverance. Doesn't it remind you a little bit of Abraham? He's about to sacrifice his son on the altar, and the knife is raised, and then God calls out to him, Abraham, Abraham. On a broader scale, you could say the sentence of condemnation is upon us as sinners. But before the sentence is executed, there comes a word that says, wait, deliver that man from the pit, for I have found a ransom. And the statement indicates to us, doesn't it, that this deliverance is grounded in a ransom. This morning, in preparation for our time around the Lord's table, I want to focus then on this theme of deliverance from the pit. Deliverance from the pit. Let's begin by looking at the pit itself. We could call this the realm of our deliverance, the realm from which we've been delivered. Delivered him from going down to the pit. The term pit is used in a number of ways in Scripture. It can refer to something as simple as a hole or a ditch, a trap for animals, something that they fall into or can be deliberately trapped by, a pit. It can also refer to a grave, which in a modern sense is a form of a pit. It has obvious metaphorical meaning, which is apparent by its use in our text here in Job 33. deliver him from going down to the pit, the text says. The picture that most readily comes to view is, or at least that comes to my view, perhaps to yours too, is a picture that occurs in Numbers 16, where you have the contest between Moses and Korah and his sons and allies. Korah and his allies have become jealous of Moses' authority. They take issue with Moses and sought to set themselves up on equal footing with Moses, and this in turn led to rebellion against Moses. This led to a demonstration on the part of Moses, proving his authority and being vindicated by God. So we read in Numbers chapter 16, beginning in verse 28, "And Moses said, Hereby ye shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own mind. If these men die the common death of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord hath not sent me. But if the Lord make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth and swallow them up with all that appertain unto them, and they go down quick into the pit, then ye shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord. And it came to pass, as he had made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground clave asunder that was under them, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, and all their goods, they and all that appertained to them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed upon them, and they perished from among the congregation." In all likelihood, this literal event, that hell itself came to be recognized as a place in the center of the earth. It was perhaps from this portion in number 16 that hell came to be regarded as a pit deep down in the earth. And to this text we can add Isaiah 14 and verse 15, which makes the connection to the pit and hell even plainer when we read, "Yet thou shalt be brought down to the hell, down to hell, to the sides of the pit." Now, death and hell are not the only usages we find behind this phrase, the pit. It can also refer to the time of your corruption, your time in sin before you were saved. So we draw the application from Psalm 40 in verse 2. "He brought me up also out of an horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings." There is a sense in which every unsaved sinner is right now, this moment, in a pit, in miry clay, at odds with God, in rebellion against God, in a part of the corruption of this world. The term can also refer, the term pit, to the depths of despair. In Psalm 88 and verse 6, the psalmist complains, "Thou hast laid me in the lowest pit, in darkness, in the deeps." It is in this sense especially that I think the term would be applied to Job. He certainly viewed himself as having sunk to the lowest pit of darkness, cut off from God, wallowing in a condition of physical and spiritual corruption. When you recognize then the scope of meaning and applications that can be drawn from this term, the pit, it certainly magnifies the greatness of our deliverance by the grace of God. When the gospel makes the announcement that the sinner is to be delivered from going down to the pit, it can find its application in every usage that's assigned to the word. Your deliverance is from the pit of hell. Your deliverance is from death itself. Your deliverance is from the depths of discouragement and despair. Deliverance applies on every level, you could say. I was looking at Psalm 30. I shared that with you. It was that psalm that kind of led me to this text. That's a psalm, you could say, that finds the psalmist beginning in the pit, though the word is not there. But in verse 1, the psalmist says in Psalm 130, Out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord. And we're not left wondering as to what those depths are. The psalmist is feeling the weight of his sin and the burden of his guilt. And so he goes on to say in verses 2 and 3, Lord, hear my voice. Let thine ears be attentive to the voice of my supplication. If thou, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who shall stand? And then comes that wonderful statement in verse 4, but there is forgiveness with thee that thou mayest be feared. We did a study on that years ago, how forgiveness of sin leads to godly fear. We'll have occasion to visit that text again in Sunday school. We're studying the fear of the Lord. I can hardly imagine not focusing on that text again. And before the psalmist is through in that psalm, we find him taken up with what is called plenteous redemption. Verse 7, let Israel hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy, and with him is plenteous redemption. And so I love the direction or the progression of Psalm 130. It begins from the depths and ends with the heights of plenteous redemption. This is what our time of communion is designed to accomplish in our hearts. The remembrance of Christ is the remembrance of our deliverance. The bread and the cup proclaim the message, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. Deliver that believer from everlasting condemnation in the pit of hell. Deliver that believer from death, which in its essence is separation from God. Deliver him from the depths of despair in which he may find himself on account of his sins or his wanderings. Oh, may you hear that message of deliverance today as you partake of these elements. May you remember your ultimate deliverance and see it as an accomplished act, and may you know present deliverance from all that would pull you down and discourage you. This is the realm of our deliverance, then. We're delivered from the pit. Would you consider with me next, secondly, the grounds for this deliverance? This, above all else, sets Elihu apart from Job's friends. You cannot cross-reference the statement of verse 24 to anything that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar say. Deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. Not once do you find Job's friends making reference to a ransom. What a rich and telling statement of gospel truth. It indicates to us that deliverance cannot simply take place out of a desire on God's part to be gracious. He must be true to himself. He must be true to the covenant he established originally with man. He cannot simply say, let's forget the terms that I made with Adam. I've changed my mind, and even though I spelled it out very clearly that there would be penalty for disobedience to the covenant, I'm simply going to dismiss my word to man that he would die if he disobeyed me. Such a thing would make God as fickle as any other sinful man. And our salvation, in that scenario, would be grounded in a whim. A whim that could as easily be replaced with another whim that could say something like, I've changed my mind again and decided to condemn man after all. The message of our text declares that there's a solid reason for this deliverance to take place. It can take place because God has found a ransom. These communion elements tell us of that ransom. Deliver him from the pit. I have found a ransom. It couldn't be just any ransom. It would have to be a qualified ransom. No mere man could pay it, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. How could a mere man pay for the sins of someone else when he must spend eternity paying for his own sins? I love the reminder of our text that this is a found ransom. I have found a ransom. I think the drama of a found ransom is the very thing that's set forth in the book of Revelation when the question is put forth in heaven by the strong angel in Revelation chapter 5 and verse 2. Who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? You remember John's reaction to the strong angel's question? We find it in verse 4 of that chapter, chapter 5, where John says, "And I wept much, because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon." It's as if a search was conducted that spanned all time and all men, and no one could step forward to advance the cause of redemption. And that's what I take that sealed scroll to be, the advancement of redemption. But what a change of emotion takes place when you go on to read in verse 5, "And one of the elders saith unto me, Weep not. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof. And when a lamb, as it had been slain, steps forward to take the scroll and to loose its seals, there follows the celebration of heavenly worship. And what does this worship amount to but praise that a ransom has been found?" So we read in verses 9 and 10 of Revelation 5, "And they sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof." Why? Why are you worthy? Why can you do it? "For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth." Doesn't that align itself with a found ransom? A found lamb as it had been slain, who can advance the cause of redemption. Let these communion elements preach to you this morning the glorious truth that a ransom has been found. There is one who is qualified to be that ransom. It's the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. He can pay that ransom because He and He alone is sinless. He can pay that ransom because He's not only man but God. He alone can satisfy the claims of violated justice. Look again at the words of Elihu in verse 32, a little further down in the chapter. "If thou hast anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify thee." Those words really are remarkable when you stop and think about them. There's no doubt that Job had sinned against God. The previous chapter, which sets the stage for Elihu's speech, makes that very plain. Look at chapter 32, verse 1. "So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes." That's not the opinion now of Eliphaz, Bildad, or Zophar. That's the statement of the narrator. Job was righteous in his own eyes. Verse 2 in that same chapter. "Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself rather than God." And doesn't that go to show you that even the best of men, even those that fear God and eschew evil, will under the right trial and under the right provocation cave into corruption and accuse God of being unfair, accuse God of mistreating him. He justified himself rather than God. And so the question that naturally arises is, why would Elihu want to justify a man who had become righteous in his own eyes? Why would he want to justify a man that was already justifying himself rather than God? We might well ask the same question with regard to our own lives. Why would God want to justify you? Why would He want to justify me? Why would God want to justify those that break His laws, who fail to measure up to His laws? Why would God justify them? On the surface of it, you could come away with the impression that for God to justify you or justify me is to justify sin itself. The reason behind God's desire to justify pertains not to us as sinners, but pertains to the gracious and glorious truth that a ransom has been found. A ransom who himself would be God manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up into glory. Our shorter catechism expresses it well when in answer to question 25 it says, Christ executeth the office of a priest in his once offering up of himself a sacrifice to satisfy divine justice and reconcile us to God, and in making continual intercession for us. Intercession, I might add, that is grounded in the sacrifice that satisfied divine justice. This is why we know that Christ's prayers will be answered for his people. He pleads the sacrifice. He pleads his own work. That's why we plead his own work in our prayers. So we've seen the realm of our deliverance. We're delivered from the pit. We've seen the grounds for our deliverance. Deliver him from the pit. I have found a ransom. It remains for us to see briefly the message of deliverance. The message of deliverance. Look at verse 23 and the beginning of verse 24. If there be a messenger with him, a messenger with this downcast man, a messenger with this one who is going down, who's headed for the pit, whatever the pit may be. If there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand to show unto man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him. I pointed out earlier that the term interpreter is translated in some versions by the word mediator. I rather like the Authorized Version translation because it broadens the scope of the application of the verse. There is and ever will be but one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. But you would hope that there would be many interpreters that could show men the right thing for them to do and to show to them God's uprightness. You would hope there would be some of those. You get the impression, however, in the context of this chapter, that there were not very many good interpreters on the scene in Job's day. His friends, while understanding certain basic things about God, were certainly not good interpreters in the sense that they could interpret God's dealings with Job. And unfortunately, when you scan the annals of church history, it reflects a sad tendency to drift away from sound interpretation and application of the truth of the gospel. In Wiley's History of Protestantism, the author traces the rise of Romanism to the inability of men to enlarge their hearts to the truth of salvation by God's free grace. The gospel is simply too magnanimous for men to adequately deal with it. And so church history becomes a sad history of degeneration into dark ages, and the need for revival and the blessing of revival, followed by darkness again. Oh, if only there were more interpreters, we're tempted to say. One of the reasons, I believe, for the institution of the Lord's table is to keep us in the realm of good interpretation and application of the gospel of Christ. In my days long ago as a Baptist, I can remember a lot of things about the church we attended before I came to the church I am a member of now. I remember a lot of things about that church that in retrospect seemed to be a loss of focus on the truths of the gospel. There was an emphasis, a strong emphasis on family. I can remember sitting through the entire prolonged Sunday school series taught by the same man twice. Not long after we had left that church, that man was divorced from his wife. Loss of focus. There was an emphasis on the family. There was at times an emphasis on dispensational prophetic schemes. And there was certainly a very strong emphasis on Christian duty. And there was also at times a spirit of oppression and discouragement, as well as unworthiness and inadequacy when it came to that Christian duty. And I think the reason for that was a loss of focus or an unhealthy balance. By way of contrast, and I'm still now speaking of that church, I've never forgotten that church's communion services. I patterned our service after the pattern of that Baptist church I attended. They stand out as indelible memories from my college days. The place would be jam-packed. We would raise the roof with our singing. Christ would be preached. The gospel would be proclaimed. The focus would be on the person and work of Christ, and our hearts were stirred like never before. Communion calls us back to the kind of focus that we find all too easy to lose. The communion service itself becomes one of a thousand to help us never forget the person and the work of Christ. So as you partake of these elements this morning, let them remind you of the realm of your deliverance. Isaiah 51 and verse 1 says, "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek the Lord. Look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged." Remember where you've come from. Remember where you were headed. Remember what you were. The New Testament version to that verse in Isaiah would be the words of Paul in Ephesians 2. Verses 10 to 12. "Wherefore remember that ye being in time past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called the circumcision in the flesh made by hands, that at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." Oh, we have to remember those days. I wouldn't recommend you dwell on them too strongly. I can't deny I find it terrifying at times to think, where would I be had the Lord not saved me? I dread to think of it. His deliverance is great. But the reason I know that and the reason I appreciate the greatness of that deliverance is I remember what I was. I remember my guilt. I remember my shame. I remember my wretchedness. I remember how dissatisfied I was, even with everything that I craved and used to feed fleshly lusts. It was dark. It was defiling. It was damnable. We've been delivered from that. We've been delivered from the pit. Make sure you hear the communion elements proclaimed this morning. Deliver him from going down to the pit. And don't miss the reason or the basis for that deliverance. Deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. Oh, may the Spirit of God himself say these things to your soul as you remember the broken body and the shed blood of Christ this day. Let's close then in prayer before we distribute the elements.